Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, it's all about martial artist and action star Bruce Lee. Writer Jeff Chang has a new book. It's called Water, Mirror, Echo, Bruce Lee and the Making of Asian America. And you'll hear us talk about Bruce Lee's life from the Bay Area to Hong Kong to Hollywood and other places in between. Today's show is about kicking down the barriers to build a legacy. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. After all of these years, people are still fascinated by the late martial artist Bruce Lee. He died in 1973 from swelling of the brain. Bruce Lee was only 32 years old, but his life was so full with family and friends, fights, philosophy, art, and more. Bruce Lee was born in San Francisco's Chinatown to immigrant parents. He moved with his family back to Hong Kong when he was a small child. Oakland was one of the cities he lived in as an adult. There are a number of biographies about Bruce Lee, but writer Jeff Chang wanted to dig even deeper into the complexities of the action star's life. Jeff Chang's book is Water, Mirror, Echo, Bruce Lee and the Making of Asian America. In it, he writes about Bruce Lee's journey along with his experiences of being Asian American and an immigrant. Jeff puts into context the socio-political events happening during Bruce Lee's lifetime that affect him personally and professionally, such as war in China and the civil rights movement. Water, Mirror, Echo is over 450 pages. So Jeff Chang and I had a lot to talk about. That's why I decided to just chat with him for the entire show. We recorded this interview on November 17th, 2025. Here's our conversation. Jeff Chang, welcome.
Hey, Janae.
Okay, so we got a lot to talk about. Okay. About this really amazing... we were laughing earlier because of the size of the book, but it's an amazing book. But for you to write a book of this size with that is so rich in information and history and story, Bruce Lee must mean a lot to you. So take us back to when you were first introduced to Bruce Lee.
Yeah, you know, there's no like singular memory of Bruce Lee. It's kind of like what I imagine it's like for my kids with hip hop. You know, like hip hop was always there for them. Like we remember a time, well, I do, maybe you don't, I'm not sure. But, a time before hip hop, there was like no time before Bruce Lee for me. It was like always Bruce Lee around. You know, as a kid, we were trying to be Bruce Lee. Everybody was trying to be Bruce Lee. I was growing up in Honolulu, Hawaii. We grew up with him on TV. We didn't really see him in the movies. We saw him in the edited versions for the TV, and we would stop everything to watch it. Yeah.
What impression do you think he had on you as a young Asian American man?
I mean, he was just our hero, you know? He was somebody that was so powerful, had so much strength, and wasn't necessarily that big. You know, he's like standing alongside Chuck Norris and you're like, how's he going to beat that dude? You know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, like, how is that going to happen? He's 5'7". I think kids especially like Bruce Lee because they can feel like they're that person, you know, that small person, ordinary looking, you know, well, maybe not ordinary looking because he's deadly handsome, right? But, yes. And he's extremely cut, but you know, like, we could identify with Bruce in that kind of a way. And that way he's, you know, I think the hero for the underdog. It's just immediately identifiable.
So Toni Morrison said, write the books that you want to read. Mm. And there are other books on Bruce Lee. What did you want to put in this book? What influenced you to write this book?
I think I probably got the contract for this book, like, not long after I wrote Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip Hop Generation. I was approached by a Korean American editor. He said, hey man, you did this book on hip hop. I think you could do something on Bruce Lee, couldn't you? I was like, sure, you know, not knowing what I was going to get into. And what I think I was interested in at the beginning, Janae, was these linkages between the kids in the Bronx in the late 60s and the early 70s and the kids in Hong Kong in the 1950s. And what I mean by that is, you know, like the kids in the Bronx, 1960s and 70s, black kids, abandoned by the government, right? Left to their own devices, housing burning down, you know, schools getting closed, music programs getting cut. But kids are always going to find a way to be creative, right? And so they come up with this thing that ends up getting called hip hop. And I was struck by the parallels because you've got the end of the Chinese Civil War in 1949. And then there's all of these refugees who pour into Hong Kong. And so they come into this British colony, and the British colonial administrators, they don't really care about the people there. They're there to extract the money, you know, and run the place and sort of be the leaders of this apartheid colony. And so there's all these kids that are coming in. They're underhoused. They're, you know, they're living in shacks on the hillside. There's every periodically these fires sweep through the hillsides and wipe out housing for tens of thousands of people at a time. And young kids are angry, but they're also creative, you know. So they're coming in. They've all been studying different forms of kung fu. And they bring their styles with them. They find their sifus there. And so they form this fight culture that's kind of parallel, right, to like b-boy, b-girl culture in a way. So I was really interested in that. And I was just struck by that. I was struck by the fact that, you know, here's a guy, Bruce Lee, who would grow up in that culture. And then, you know, all these years later, he would influence kids who grew up on hip-hop. And that was like my backwards entry into this. But during the pandemic, it became much deeper because we were experiencing, when I say those of us of Asian and Pacific Islander and Native Hawaiian descent living here on the continent, we were experiencing a lot of vulnerability through, you know, the violence that was being visited on us. And I think at that point, everybody was thinking a lot about like how vulnerable we were, how unsafe we were. And thinking about self-defense, you know, I started taking Kajikembo, which is a martial art developed in Hawaii, which Kung Fu is a major part of it. And the image of Bruce Lee kind of appeared in all of these walls. So Oakland Chinatown, I remember, San Francisco Chinatown. And the image of Bruce meant something different at that point, you know. For us in our generation, like the image of Bruce Lee getting ready to get busy on two turntables, that was our image of Bruce. But for this generation, it was like,
and this was something that was like,
yeah, circular t-shirts and you know, magazines. Yeah. It was in zines and it was in t-shirts and, you know, posters and all that kind of stuff. But for this generation, it was the image of Bruce being strong, you know, and being a symbol of unity and pride and, hey, we got this. And also solidarity, like, hey, can you see, if you can see Bruce, can you see what's happening to us? And then for us, it's like, if we can see Bruce, can we see what's happening to other folks at that time as well? Because, of course, 2020, right? Like George Floyd. So self-defense is for real, for real. And I think in that regard, I was like, oh, actually, there's a bigger story here to be written.
The title, Water, Mirror, Echo, is really beautiful. And I understand it comes from the, at least in your book, it comes from the Taoist poem or saying, moving, be like water, still be like a mirror, respond like an echo. How does that reflect Bruce Lee? That was something too that he lived by, right? That was something he was passionate about, that those words.
Yeah, I first read it in this book that Bruce wrote, but it was compiled by another set of folks. It's called the Tao Te Kundo, and it's one of those books that everybody knows from Bruce. And this compilation of all of these sayings were taken from his notes. You know, these are his raw notes. These are just notes that he had taken on books and notes that he had written to himself. You know, it was released and it was meant to be sort of a combination of a teaching manual and a philosophical manual. And so when I first read those words in that compilation, I was just knocked out. I literally stopped reading. I closed the book and I was in a residency on a farm in upstate New York, and I just like closed the book And I just walked outside and I walked for like hours just going, what does that mean? You know, it was,
wow.
It was, yeah, it was wild. But I came back to it later on because as, you know, Shannon Lee, Bruce's daughter, gave me access to his papers, all of his papers. And I realized as I was going through all these papers that it would come up over and over again throughout his life. Like he would reflect on this and he would write something down, you know. Initially, I think that he wanted to apply it to fighting, of course, to martial arts. Mm-hmm. And so he was teaching his students to be like water. And I think that's, of course, the most famous Bruce Lee line that we know today. But there would be other lines in there about trying to be like a mirror, you know, like when you're facing off against your opponent, you're not trying to make the first move. You are waiting for that person to act, and then you're literally being like a mirror, and then you're being responsive like an echo. Like he would write these notes of this kind of nature. And I should say that at points in his life when he was feeling down, he would return back to this particular poem, and he would, or lines, it's not really a poem, it's like lines from this book called the Liza. And he would try to puzzle it out and try to figure out like how to make a way forward. Make a way as out of no way, as he would say, and as of course is resonates deeply right within Black American culture as well, this making a way out of no way.
If you're just joining us, I'm chatting with award-winning author Jeff Chang. His book, Water Mirror Echo, Bruce Lee and the Making of Asian America, is out now. And it's a really amazing biography of Bruce Lee. And he has such an interesting relationship with water. You write in the book, he didn't know how to swim. He admired water, respected water. But he knew water could be
feared it.
He knew water could be dangerous and powerful and soothing. And so that's the water mirror echo. It all flows. So he was born in San Francisco Chinatown in 1940, and then he moved back to Hong Kong with his family when he was a small child, a baby. I think I thought it was funny because when he was a baby, he played a baby girl in a movie.
Yeah,
and I was like, he took that bonnet off when he got older. He was kicking butt.
Yes, that's right. He was cross-dressing in his first acting role at the age of however many weeks.
He was a little baby.
Yeah.
He was a cute little baby.
Really cute.
And so, you know, the significance of him being both, you know, an immigrant. He was born here in the United States. I know you said he would be referred to as an anchor baby today. But he was born here in the United States. But also, too, he was an immigrant because he left when he was a baby or a small child and moved back with his family to Hong Kong. And just carrying that dynamic.
Yeah.
What's the significance of him, especially when we going back to the title of The Making of Asian America?
Yeah. I mean, in this particular moment, it's wild that the book got released this year, you know. At the beginning of the year, you know, Donald Trump releases this executive order basically saying, if you're the child of people who are here on a temporary visa, you will be deported. We are getting rid of birthright citizenship. This is one of his first executive orders. So under that executive order, and it's been held up in the courts now, and people are expecting that the Supreme Court will rule on it this year, the Lee family would have been deported. Bruce Lee would not be American.
I thought about that when I was reading that.
Yeah. And so that's deep. You know, it's really real. It underscores just a radical project of the Trump, you know, administration to undo something that's basically been an accepted American way of understanding citizenship and the law, and just, you know, the utter white supremacist kind of thinking behind it, right? So the book gets published this year, and I titled the first chapter Anchor Baby. And of course, I didn't know that this was going to be coming up, but it was, and it's weird, right? It's just strange. You know, one of the things that's kind of strange too is in the reception of the book, we did a bunch of different videos on Bruce Lee, just to kind of break down little points about Bruce's life, you know, for the social media and all that kind of stuff for another generation of folks. And so the first one was called, you know, Bruce Lee was an anchor baby. And you had people in there who were objecting to that. Like, how can you say that? He was American, you know, like. Then I did another one, How Bruce Lee Became American, which is about his immigrant journey, right? His journey to come back to the U.S. and what it meant for him to learn what it meant to be a racialized minority in the U.S., but also to go through that process, right, of adapting, being like water, right, to adapting to his environment and learning how to live. And to me, that particular journey is crucial because that's what takes him from being this sort of privileged kid, right, this sort of teen idol movie star. He has a driver, he has cooks, he has like maids in his house and that kind of thing. And he's
and this is when he's in Hong Kong.
When he's in Hong Kong, exactly. And then he's put on a slow boat to San Francisco at the age of 18. He's got $100 in his pocket and he has to figure out how to make it. Just like a lot of other migrants to this country. And the thing is about this debate between whether or not Bruce Lee was an immigrant or an American, the thing that strikes me is that we've regressed so much in our discussion here that we don't even talk about America being a land of immigrants, which is untrue, you know, right? But we don't even talk about that anymore. Now we debate whether somebody is an American or an immigrant. In Bruce Lee's life, there's all these answers and they all point in the direction of like a politics, a cultural disposition that is towards openness and inclusion and freedom. And if people disagree with that, then they actually really don't know who Bruce Lee is.
And you mentioned in the book when his parents immigrated here from Hong Kong, they had to go through Angel Island.
They had to go through Angel Island.
You know, in San Francisco, mm-hmm. Which is where, you know, Asians or Chinese specifically were detained when trying to immigrate to the United States. And when he moved back here at 18, mm-hmm. Because... like I said, Bruce Lee, when he got to be a little kid, he took that bonnet off and was kicking butt.
He was kicking butt. He liked to fight. He was in the streets.
Bruce Lee fighting. Was in the streets.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, with his fists and his legs doing his thing. It's true. Yes.
What was up with him fighting so much?
You know, like I said, child star, right? He's a little spoiled. He's also bullied. Okay, so Bruce comes back and they're on the verge of war. The Japanese have already occupied large parts of China, and on December 8th, 1941, like literally the same 24 hours that they bombed Pearl Harbor, they are bombing Hong Kong as well, right? And he barely survives the war, so he's a war baby too. His parents are superstitious. They've just seen a lot of babies die. Mm. Infant mortality is really, really high at this particular point, and wartime has broke out, and the Japanese have taken the rice stock, and they've shipped it back to Japan because Japan's having a rice shortage as well, and also because they can. That's what imperialists do. So people in Hong Kong are starving. His father has to play this dance with the Japanese cultural ministry, who want him to do propaganda for the Japanese, like, hey, we're great. Like, try to convince all of your friends and neighbors and Hong Kongers that Japanese are going to rule better than the British did. And of course they're not, you know, they're just as brutal as the British were. And so they're worried that Bruce is going to die. Mm-hmm. He's their, you know, youngest kid at that time. They're worried he's going to die. They put an earring on him. They dress him like a girl because they don't want the evil spirits to come and claim his life. Right. Because they believe that the spirits are out to get the boys in particular. Mm. And so, you know, Bruce is going to a primarily boys school and he's getting taunted. He's getting bullied at a very young age. And I think that that's what causes him to act out. You know, he's got nobody to back him up. And so he tries to learn. He's on the set actually asking older guys to teach him how to fight, like, you know, kung fu moves or that kind of thing. His dad tries to get him to Tai Chi. Bruce is like, this is too slow. I can't, what am I right. going to do with this? and so, you know, so he grows up, he's bullied, and he finds, I think, by the age of 13 that he actually likes fighting and he doesn't win all the time. So he gets a friend of his to take him, to teach him what he knows, which is a style of kung fu named Wing Chun. And his friend William Chung takes him to a famous master named Yip Man. And he studies in Yip Man's Kun, largely under a guy named Wan Chung Leong, for years. So when Bruce is in his teens, very handsome, he's wearing cashmere sweaters on screen, like the girls love him, but he's also trying to be, you know, flexing himself with the guys. And so he's going out in the streets and trying to stir up trouble, and he's trying to cause fights, and he gets into one too many fights, and that's why his parents say, "Nah, you're done here." His brother's convinced that he's going to get himself killed because he's even fighting people who are triad affiliated. And so at the age of 18, he's on this slow boat to San Francisco.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with award-winning author Jeff Chang. His book, Water, Mirror, Echo, Bruce Lee and the Making of Asian America, is out now. And it's a really, really unique biography of the martial artist, the great Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee was not only a fighter, you know, and also, too, he was a fighter in many ways. And one of the things I love about the book, Jeff, is that we see the artist Bruce Lee. We see Bruce Lee as the artist. His parents were both artists. His mom was a flapper dancer, and his father performed in a theater troupe. He studied philosophy in college at University of Washington. I know he also enrolled at UC Berkeley. I don't know if he, I can't recall if he,
Never did.
He ended up he never did.
Yeah, he never.
Okay,
his heart was in the right place. He said that he did. He told his friend William Chung that he did, but he never actually did.
Okay, so he did. Okay, so Bruce. Okay, Bruce Lee was telling stories. You know, in the book, you know, we see that he read and wrote poetry. He was a cha-cha dancer too, as well.
Yeah.
And I was looking at him fighting, and I was wondering too if some of that dancing, of course, and learning how to box too. But I was like, I wonder if that even played a role in him as a fighter. Can you talk about this side of him as an artist, all that arts background?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Bruce grew up in an artist family. His dad was one of the like most respected actors of his time, first in the Cantonese opera. And then when the Hong Kong movie industry takes off, he's like one of the most in-demand artists. He's a comedian and could lead, you know, lots of movies and plays and stuff. So Bruce is always growing up around this, and he like is heading to the movie sets at a very young age. The thing about Bruce is he's very much a dreamer. He's very much an artist. From the time that he's little, the thing that he loves is to read these kung fu novels, these wuxia novels that are all the rage among the kids, but he just devours them. And then he's somebody who also loves to draw. So, you know, comic strips are taking off at this particular time, and he picks up on that. He becomes actually a very skilled artist with the pen and the paper and the pencil and the paper. You know, at the age of 18, when he's getting ready to go back to the U.S., he actually starts reading all the books he's been ignoring for a little bit. You know, he comes back to reading. And at that time, he starts picking up lots of martial arts manuals at first because he's thinking, I'm going to try to figure out how to get better, even if I'm not, you know, training day in, day out like I used to. And what he finds in those martial arts manuals is actually a lot of references to Chinese philosophy and Asian philosophies. And so that makes him dive deeper into Asian philosophy. He goes, he reads the classics. Suddenly he's like this autodidact. He's just, you know, he's everywhere he goes, he's got a book. And you know, in the first like year, especially, I think, of him being in the U.S., he's really lonely. And so his constant companions are these books. He just, he purchases all of these books. And so that allows like this flowering in his mind of all of these new types of associations. And he really especially takes to Taoism and to Zen Buddhism. At this particular time on the West Coast, you know, there's a guy named Alan Watts who is making Zen Buddhism accessible to like the beatniks and the counterculture and that kind of stuff.
Right.
Alan Watts has his own feelings about the beatniks, but they're all devouring these books, and so is Bruce. Bruce is taking to these books. He's got a ruler and pencils and pens, and he's highlighting these things in red and blue, and he's like trying to translate the stuff into his fighting, but also just into a philosophy of life. And so that's kind of who he is. You know, he was never going to be a 9-to-5 guy. You know, and through
not.
He was never going to be that guy. And then when he gets the opportunity, which is a surprise, to actually act again, to actually have a chance to break into Hollywood, he just jumps at it.
So Jeff, so Bruce Lee came to California, back to California around 18. He bounced to Seattle, which also was a place that had a lot of influence. And so he's lived in San Francisco and Oakland. And, you know, I was very passionate about this book because I knew, I didn't know a lot about Bruce Lee, but one thing I knew about Bruce Lee was that Bruce Lee lived in Oakland. And not just Oakland, Bruce Lee lived in East Oakland.
That's right, in Maxwell Park. Yeah.
That's right. That's yep. right. So I was very excited. His son, Brandon Lee, was born in East Oakland at the Oakland Hospital on East 14th.
Yeah.
So I was, and of course, in downtown Oakland, he had his school. So I was very excited, too, about this book because I wanted to get as much Oakland information as possible. And I thought it was interesting that when he and his wife, they had a shotgun wedding, basically in Seattle. They met at University of Washington. They had a shotgun wedding. And then after the shotgun wedding, they flew to Oakland.
Yeah.
And that's a very Bay Area story, an interracial couple with a shotgun wedding, and they fled to Oakland.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, Seattle, he met a lot of different people. People who were influenced by different people of different races that taught him different styles of martial arts. And then he comes to Oakland. He's, you know, he's older. Again, a diverse place. Oakland is not San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Oakland is still not San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Both great cities, but they both got to have their own style. Mm-hmm. I feel like, I don't know, reading, I say Bruce Lee's kind of scrappy.
Yeah. For sure.
And I'll say this as somebody born and raised in Oakland. He fits in. With East Oakland.
Yeah, you know, in the Bay Area.
East Oakland was different at that time.
You got San Francisco claiming them and Oakland claiming them. But, you know, I'm East Bay, too.
And we can all claim them.
Yeah,
we can.
But definitely.
I mean, it's a scene where you talk about he went to visit his friend in Alameda. And I was like, I live in Alameda. I'm like, Bruce Lee walked away at Alameda.
That's right.
So, yeah. But I do want to talk about Oakland because I know he's often talked about San Francisco. Mm. Why did he move to Oakland and not San Francisco? What was it about Oakland that drew him here to do his martial arts thing?
You know, it's so interesting because it does fit in some of these sort of stereotypes or these sort of Oakland, San Francisco, you know, back and forth that we hear and participate in as well. You look at San Francisco Chinatown, it's one of the most storied Chinatowns in the world, right? It's at one point, it's the biggest Chinatown in the world. And everybody knows of it. During this particular period is the Chinese Exclusion Act. The Chinese Exclusion Act is still in effect. And that actually has this really profound effect on the way that these Chinatowns are formed, right? So if you're thinking about Kung Fu as a martial art, the main Kuns are in San Francisco Chinatown. And they're formed basically for two reasons. One is to produce folks who are going to be the enforcers in Chinatown. And two, it's to be able to teach people in Chinatown the skills to be able to preserve themselves, to protect themselves when they walk a couple of blocks up the hill into Nob Hill or a couple of blocks down the hill into the financial district. And they're no longer in Chinatown. They're in a white neighborhood. So at the beginning of the 1960s, what you start seeing is a softening in immigration laws. And there's actually a couple of waves of immigrants who are coming in, mainly from Hong Kong to the Chinatowns. And that creates a whole new kind of vibe, right? Now there's tension between the new immigrants and the folks who have been there for generations. And Bruce kind of steps into the middle of this when he comes to Oakland Chinatown. He is getting down with a person who has been living in Oakland Chinatown and was born and raised, a guy named James Yim Lee. Mm-hmm. And James has been studying Kung Fu in San Francisco Chinatown for years, but he's getting tired of, you know, being like one of the guys in the Kuun that knows the best, that represents the Kuun the best, but he's not getting like the lessons that that he's waiting on being taught, because the older guys, they don't necessarily want to teach everybody everything. You know, they want to save that for their kids so that their kids can become the Sifus. And so James is getting restless with this. And finally, he has a big argument because he's one of these guys that wants to popularize Kung Fu. And the folks in Chinatown, the older folks, they don't want to popularize Kung Fu. It serves a purpose, which I just told you about, right? And so, you know, James and Bruce meet because they're part of this generation of folks that are challenging the kind of dominance of the Kung Fu Coons in San Francisco Chinatown. So Bruce comes to live with James Yim Lee, and through James, he's meeting all of these mavericks, all of these guys who are tilting against the Kung Fu power structure, if you will, in Chinatown. And in that sense, he is seen as scrappy, but the San Francisco Chinatown folks also see him as a dude that's kind of, you know, a loudmouth, and they don't like him. And so when Bruce comes to San Francisco Chinatown and tries to recruit folks to join, you know, his and James's coon on Broadway in Oakland, like the San Francisco Chinatown Kung Fu folks come out in force and they're hectoring him. They're heckling him, you know, they're laughing at him. And Bruce gets mad. And so, you know, who knows what really actually happened in there? But the story is...
I was going to ask you about that.
The story is...
with Wong Jackman.
That's right. So the story
is... I knew about that.
Everybody knows about that story. And everybody says that Bruce fought Wong Jackman because he needed to make Kung Fu available to be taught to non-Chinese. And I just think that that's a myth, man. Like, if you look at who Wong Jackman was, he taught a lot of non-Chinese, including people that I learned from. I know people who were taught by both Bruce Lee and Wong Jackman, you know, who were non-Chinese. It's a story that kind of gets invented later on.
Let's pause. I want to go back real quick just so people understand. So Bruce Lee and Wong Jackman got in a fight at Bruce Lee's school on Broadway in Oakland. Right. And so there was this tension, kind of what you said earlier about there were people in the Chinese community who were like, we don't want you teaching this martial art Kung Fu to people outside of the Chinese community.
No, I don't think that that was it. I don't think that that was the primary reason that they had the fight, right?
I'm not saying that was the primary reason. I'm just saying that's what was going on around then. What do you think was the cause of the fight? Because that's what the rumor was, like what you said, was like, oh, we're fighting. They're fighting because Bruce Lee wants to teach people who aren't Chinese Kung Fu and Wong Jackman didn't.
There are already people who are teaching non-Chinese folks in Chinatown, you know, including some of the big name leaders who are part of the big name coons. So that was absolutely not the reason in my mind. And, you know, people argue with me and stuff, but I'm not the only person that says this, right? I think the reason that they got into a fight was basically Bruce was in a time when there's a lot of tensions between immigrants, so-called FOBs, fresh off the boats, and those who have been in Chinatown for generations, ABCs, American-born Chinese, right? And there's a lot of tension, and it gets much, much more intense over the next decade and a half in Chinatown. Those folks see Bruce as the loudmouth, rude immigrant, right? And Wong Jackman comes in, and he's seen as the respectful, courteous, like well-educated immigrant. He's come through all the Kung Fu school, like the most storied Kung Fu schools in Hong Kong. He knows forms from all of these different types of schools. And he's a nice guy. He's basically a very quiet, humble guy. He works at a restaurant, you know what I mean? And so they're like, oh, let's go get him to fight this loudmouth, rude immigrant, you know, after they have this little confrontation between Bruce and the San Francisco Kung Fu kids who are out there heckling him in this theater, where he's just doing a presentation to try to get people to come to his Oakland Chinatown coon. So there's all these tensions that are going on. There's ABC versus FOB. There's Oakland versus San Francisco. There's all this other kind of stuff that's going on. And that's why they have this challenge fight, right? Which is a fight that's only seen by a small number of people and has become storied because Wong Jackman supposedly lost this fight. And so I tell the story over the course of like 2+ chapters or so in the book. But I just want to cure people of that thing, because it's a story that makes it seem as if the Chinese Americans who were teaching Kung Fu in San Francisco Chinatown were bigots. And I don't think that that was their thing. You know, I think that, you know, there might have been bigots in there that were like, you can never teach these types of folks. But they were teaching Kung Fu during the era of the Chinese Exclusion Act to protect themselves, as well as to be able to kind of enforce certain kinds of power structures in Chinatown, which is a whole other episode.
If you're just joining us, I'm chatting with award-winning author Jeff Chang. His book, Water Mirror Echo, Bruce Lee and the Making of Asian America, is out now. And it's a really amazing biography of Bruce Lee. So, Jeff, let's talk Hollywood now. So eventually Bruce gets a call while he's living in Oakland that he's going to be on the Green Hornet. And he plays Kato, the Green Hornet sidekick. And I wanted to also talk about his wife, Linda, too, as well, in relation to that role. Mm. Again, like I said earlier, they met when they were students at University of Washington. And at the time, Loving versus Virginia was happening, which is the Supreme Court case, which eventually ruled that interracial marriages were legal. Mm-hmm. And so there was hostility from both sides of their families. Her family didn't approve. His family didn't either, but they warmed up to it. Her family pretty much were like, no. And so what I found really interesting in your book was that when he was on the Green Hornet, ABC kind of utilized the press or they were on board with the press exoticizing Bruce Lee and Linda's interracial relationship and their baby, Brandon Lee. And I remember it was an article you referenced that was like, I want to have a mixed up kid. And it was white women journalists writing these articles, exoticizing them. I guess that's the word. I don't know. It was a fetish. It was that. I thought that was strange. But I know that was a different time. Can you just talk about that? Like, and him being with Linda, who is white, like, how did that affect his career?
Yeah, it was a very, very interesting time, right? So just to go back and set the stage, like you were talking about, this is a period during which polls show that 2/3 of Americans, and we're going to say white Americans here, because that's what the polls were about back then, were against interracial marriage. At the same time, you have this case where a black and Native American woman and a white man get married in Virginia. They are literally thrown into jail because of that. And so they created a case that goes all the way to the Supreme Court, basically trying to challenge this anti-miscegenation law in Virginia, right? The case doesn't get resolved till 1967. Bruce is on the air in 1966. The case is still in the Supreme Court. Anti-interracial marriage laws have not yet been invalidated by the Supreme Court. On the West Coast, what you got is this Asian American actor who is about to be like the biggest Asian American actor on TV since Anna May Wong, and certainly the biggest Asian American male ever on TV, like in a co-starring role. And nobody has ever done a media campaign to promote an Asian American male actor, right? Ever. I mean, this is about the same time that George Takei is getting onto Star Trek, but there's nobody else, right? They're like Hop Sing. They're like on Bonanza. Like they're playing these like sort of, you know, minstrel type characters. And so Bruce is about to be on the show, and the press agents, the media publicists are like, how are we going to promote this guy? And somebody there, I don't know who, but somebody there is like, oh, we'll promote his marriage because he married a white woman. And we'll promote the kid because the kid is a mixed race kid. And so literally they have Bruce doing all of these magazine interviews with these sort of newsstand magazines that are TV and movie and radio tabloids. All of them, just all of them were about like, oh, Bruce, here's an Oriental guy. It's just like the white guy next door. You know what I mean? He like, he has this white wife, you know, I'm going to say this too, Janae. He likes his women like in the kitchen, right? This is part of the articles. I'm just saying, right?
Okay.
And they have this kid and they're like curious. They're like, how are they going to raise this kid? Are they going to raise him with baseball or some weird game that they play in China? Are they going to Are they going to take him to like a Christian church, or are they going to have him study Buddhism? Like, what are they going to do? Like, these are what the articles are asking. You know, there's so much fascination around him. So what's interesting is the Green Hornet then becomes this show where all of these housewives who are buying these magazines, when they go to the supermarket to shop, right, for the week, to bring home the food that they're going to cook for their husbands, that's who the target audience is for these magazines. Like, they become one of the target audiences for the Green Hornet. And at the same time, through these articles, there's a strong undercurrent of interracial marriage is not a bad thing. Let's get used to it, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was one of the most unexpected types of things that I would have ever encountered, like, starting my research on Bruce Lee.
It helped him. It was also too racist and weird. And I'm thinking, too, again, you know, he was nice looking, too, as well. And I'm wondering if they, you know, ABC used that to their advantage, too, marketing him.
Absolutely.
You know, he's a handsome man to these white women. I just thought that was deep, but I was like, I had to ask you about that.
No, it's cool. Like, they have pictures of him literally, like, it, like, doing kung fu and that, and just looking like very handsome, dashing. And I don't know if he's shirtless in these magazines. I have to go back and check. But yeah, but also, you know, in these family photos of the three of them, of Bruce, Linda, and Brandon.
You really tapped into his vulnerability too, as well, you know, in the book. And while he's making the Green Hornet, you mentioned he has imposter syndrome, and sometimes you look through his journals and he's like, what am I doing here? Mm-hmm. Why am I here? Do I belong? Mm-hmm. Also, too, he's wrestling with Hollywood because he doesn't want to play a stereotypical Asian servant, mm-hmm. you know, and he knows how great he is, too, as well. Right. He knows his greatness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Expand more about his vulnerable side and him as an Asian American man, just dealing with racism in Hollywood.
Yeah, you know, after the Green Hornet ends, it only plays one season. You know, it doesn't really reach the levels of popularity that anybody wanted, so the show's canceled. Bruce himself, you know, for a few months, he's still making all of these appearances at these martial arts competitions. They're paying him really big money to do that. And he's like, I'm excited. I think I'm going to be able to get another star. I'm going to get a starring role. Now, mind you, there's never been a show on TV in which there's been an Asian American male as a lead, you know, but he's like, he thinks he's going to get it. And so he goes out for all of these auditions, and year after year after year, he's finding that the only parts that he can get are to be a fight choreographer, to choreograph the fights for other people. Or to play these bit roles that are sometimes like just borderline insulting or stereotypical or racist. And he realizes that he's never going to play the person that he is in his head, which is the main character, as long as he stays in Hollywood. So, you know, he gets the opportunity to try out for this TV show called Kung Fu. And everybody, all the Asian American actors in Hollywood are, that's Bruce's role. He's the one who's popularized the martial art of Kung Fu, and he's also a talented actor, but he goes out for the part and he gets rejected because the producer says, we don't understand him. We can't understand what he's saying. He has an Asian American accent, you know, to them, to these guys, it's not going to play in Middle America. And so Bruce is like, at that point, he's like, okay, I understand. They don't want me here. And that's why he goes back to Hong Kong and blows up. And so he concentrates for the next year and a half on becoming the biggest star in Asia, which he does, to the point where Hollywood can no longer ignore him. And that's when he decides that he's going to try to make this movie, you know, with his own kind of juice, his own kind of power, to represent Asians in the best light, Asian philosophy and Asian fighting arts. And that movie is what becomes Enter the Dragon.
I love that he didn't let Hollywood stop him during his life, which was sadly so short. But as he's emerging, there's a civil rights movement. There's a Black Power movement, which influences the Yellow Power movement. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship between his presence on screen and Black progressive movement. Mm.
Well, Bruce was never a political activist directly, you know. He right. was somebody who was educated about what it meant to be a minority in the U.S. by his first student, a Black man named Jesse Glover, who wanted to learn Kung Fu because he had been beaten at the age of 12 by white drunken police in Seattle. And so he's one of, you know, the most influential people in terms of Bruce understanding what's going on. And then later on, he's training Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and he's telling Kareem, you know, because they've both been under the spotlight since they were kids. So they form this friendship really quickly, and they just understand each other. He's telling Kareem, man, they don't see me as a main character here. I might have to go back to Hong Kong. And Kareem's like, I understand. And Kareem is giving him history lessons. So Kareem's like, man, did you understand that in Shanghai there were these parks that they didn't allow Chinese into? And he's like, word? You know what I mean? And that ends up in Fist of Fury later on when he kicks that sign down, right? No dogs in Chinese mm-hmm. allowed. Like Kareem, he's giving Kareem martial arts lessons. He's giving him the Book of Five Rings by Miyamoto Musashi, this martial arts classic. And Kareem is giving him histories of China and colonialism in China. The British, the Germans, you know, the Portuguese, on and on and on. So he is growing, I think, into this as he's becoming more and more, quote unquote, Asian American. He's growing into understanding what it means to be identifying with the oppressed of the world. And that's who he plays. He ends up playing that person in the movies. And I think Enter the Dragon does a lot to solidify him as a third world icon. You know, so if we were talking a little bit earlier about Fist of Fury, that movie is playing in Chinatown, right? Because they're not going to play in the, it's not going to play in Concord at that time. It's not playing in Walnut Creek. It's playing in Chinatown. So all the folks from the Third World Liberation Front are at this theater in Chinatown watching Bruce like fight the Imperial Japanese and kicking down these signs, right? So even though Bruce is not a political activist, he has this meaning for folks at that particular point, when they're struggling for, you know, liberation on the campuses, you know, in the communities all across the country, but particularly in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York City and Seattle. And then when Enter the Dragon comes out, there's so much symbolism in that, right? They had cast him as one of three actors, a white guy, John Saxon, a Black guy, Jim Kelly, and him, because they thought an Asian American man was not going to be able to hold the lead all by himself. But that kind of changes the whole picture, right?
No, I don't think none of those ladies reading that magazine.
Right, exactly. And now you got, you know, Bruce is fighting. He's fighting and fighting to make the movie that he wants. He actually boycotts the film for a little while in order to get the scenes at the beginning of the movie where he's talking about Asian philosophy, Taoist and Zen Buddhist philosophy. And he's the one that directs the last scene in the Hall of Mirrors, which becomes sort of a metaphor for representation of folks like, you know, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, Black Americans as well, right? He's fighting the stereotype. The stereotype is the Fu Manchu character, Han. But to be in this movie, and there's scenes like Jim Kelly coming out into Hong Kong Harbor and saying, you know, seeing the sampans and the poor people living on them and saying, ghettos, they're the same all around the world, you know, no matter where you go, right? And to see Bruce fighting to free literally people who have been enslaved, and, you know, men and women who have been enslaved by this evil man who's distributing drugs. That everybody that is watching this movie is like, oh, I see. He's a third world hero. And I think that that's what's resonated to today, you know, so that everybody all around the world sees him as an icon of the oppressed, of the folks who feel like they've been stepped on.
I have one more question. I know we have to go soon. You know, you write in the book that Bruce Lee has been seen, you know, since he's passed away, has been seen as narcissistic and an Asian who didn't know his place. And you said some filmmakers have kind of conveyed that. You mentioned Quentin Tarantino as one. How does your book challenge that?
Well, I mean, if you look at his writings, you know, he wasn't a narcissist like woe is me-ing all the time because people don't see me. He was more somebody who was trying to ensure that Asians and Asian Americans would be portrayed in the best light possible. That was really his aim in the last year of his life in making this movie, Enter the Dragon. And so I was kind of stunned to learn about all of these fights that he was having behind the scenes with his producers. Everybody is just like, oh, he got the movie made. He made it. He's like, he's the guy. But no, he like I said, he was willing to throw the whole movie away because he wasn't going to get represented the way that he needed to seen. And more importantly, for his fans, his audiences that he wanted to represent to see him. He knew that if he made a movie that didn't reflect that, that A, his career would be over, but B, he couldn't live with himself. You know, what looks like narcissism to some folks, I think, is literally the kind of thing that was the mission that some of his friends say killed him, you know? Mm. He died early. He died at the age of 32. He was incredibly exhausted at the end of his life. His friends and family members were all extremely worried about him. He has this sort of mysterious type of death where he takes an over-the-counter pill and that results in brain swelling. But it was the second time that that had happened in under a year. And and so, you know, he was fighting and fighting and fighting. And when you look at his papers, especially from the last year in his life, it was clear he wasn't sleeping. He was up late at night, you know, trying to figure out all the angles to make sure that he could make the movie that he needed to make. Some might call that narcissistic, but in these papers, what's revealed is that he feels like he really, really needs to do this the right way. And he put his all into it. And so that's sort of the way that this book may be different from other people's books. And not just books, but movies or articles. There's a school of thought that is like, Bruce needs to be taken down a couple of notches. And that's not the school that I come from. I think that Bruce broke through the bamboo ceiling in Hollywood. And the saddest thing about it is that it took us two more generations to really fulfill the promise of what was there after he broke through that bamboo ceiling.
Jeff Check, I could talk to you about this a whole nother hour, but I'm going to have to catch you next time you come to KLW because I have more questions for you.
We will
this
do
is
it.
An incredible book. Congratulations on this. You know, you said that Bruce Lee made Asian Americans feel seen, mm-hmm. and I felt like with this book, you made him feel seen in a deeper way. Mm-hmm. So thank you for Janae. Putting this out in the world.
Thank you, Janae. Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful time talking with you.
Jeff Chang is the author of Water, Mirror, Echo, Bruce Lee and the Making of Asian America. It's available in bookstores now. Again, we recorded that interview on November 17th, 2025. Make sure to check out Jeff's podcast, Notes from the Edge, which is produced by KALW Public Media. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.